This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Rays Radio Network proudly presents This Week in Rays Baseball. Here's your host, Neil Solons.
Thanks so much for joining us for our latest podcast. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. There are two subjects on the podcast today from a Rays perspective. One is the fact that Tampa Bay has now 7 arbitration cases, which is the most the franchise has had. They had 14 potential cases. They settled half of them. That news came down on Friday afternoon, and I chatted with President of Baseball Operations Eric Neander, and we'll hear from him momentarily. And then on Sunday, the international classes were announced for the latest period, which began on Sunday. The Rays signing a total of 24 players, 12 from the Dominican Republic, 12 from Venezuela, and Steve Miller, who heads up that effort, will chat with us in a little bit. But we begin with President of Baseball Operations Eric Neander, who touched on kind of the whys and wherefores of how the Rays ended up with a total of 7 cases.
Yeah, it's a look. First and foremost, as far as the makeup of our team going this year, this doesn't affect anything. This is about part of the, you know, player's journey, where they've earned the right to, you know, to go back and forth on an appropriate salary. And these steps are in place to resolve any honest disagreements. And you know, last year, I believe we had 13 cases. They were all settled. This year, I believe we had 14, and we were only able to agree on 7 of them, which is unique. I believe it's unprecedented, you know, at least in my experience here. But it can happen. And I think, you know, more potential for it to happen, you know, when not necessarily disagreement over a player's contributions, but just the uniqueness of their path. And, you know, when you think about someone like Jeffrey Springs, you know, think about someone like Harold Ramirez and their journeys, you know, it opens up more room to have, I think, what are honest disagreements about just how to appropriately balance everything, you know, to that point in their career. So I believe we put our work in. We did our best to, you know, to operate in good faith. Very much believe that in each situation, players, their agents did exactly the same. And there just can be honest disagreements about how to interpret things within this process. So, you know, we'll go through it. We'll get it taken care of, and we'll keep going. It just is part of it, you know. And at the same time, I think, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I think one of our most accomplished, if not the most accomplished player, Randy Rosarena, like, we got that done, you know. So it's not even necessarily a matter of earnings potential and the like. It just is truly about the disagreements that can occur or how you interpret a jury to a point in time.
You mentioned the size of the class, and I think that was what first came to mind was, oh, you have 14 cases. It's hard to get 14 cases settled. But you also mentioned last year was 13, and all of them were agreed to. Was last year more of a surprise or more of a surprise that you have so many that are still left to figure out now?
As I just kind of wandered through my last explanation, I think each year is unique. Each case is unique. And the less common a given journey might be through this process, the more room there is just to have, you know, differences of opinion about how to best put that together. But I don't know. I think, you know, to me, it'll land wherever it lands. Sometimes you get them all done, sometimes you don't. But as long as both sides are operating good faith and trying to find that common ground, I think that's all you can ask for. And feel very much both last year when we got them all done, this year when we didn't, that, you know, that was certainly the spirit which both sides acted throughout. And I think that you focus on that part more than the ultimate outcome. Obviously, you'd like to get them done, but we judge it more by the effort and the intentions. But I would say that they were constant in both years, and they ended up in very different places, certainly.
The hearings themselves would all be done by February 17th, which is before all players or your full squad is due to report. How do you make sure as a staff you move beyond that? Like, because an arbitration hearing can be difficult sometimes for a player if they're sitting in on it, or just the fact that you've got to, you know, be honest about why you feel about your side.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I don't know in any situation that we're in. I think that my job description is different than a player's job description, thankfully, for our team. Their agent's job description is different than mine, and so on and so forth. And I think you just have to own your role in this. And I think there's a way to do that, to speak candidly and honestly about that, and to be respectful of all parties involved at the same time. And, I don't know if that's the best way or there's a better way to do it. I just think if you can be honest, if you can be respectful, be truthful, own your role in this thing, even when you have disagreements, you know, such as these, there's ways past them. And I think at the end of the day, for the players, the coaches, the coaches aren't involved in this process. They're trying to do everything they can to help the players be as good as they could be, as are we, from a different perspective. And it's just part of it. And like I said, as long as I think you go through this whole process, looking to find common ground, looking to understand the other side, operating in good faith in that respect, then, you know, sometimes the disagreements aren't really even about how you value the players, you know, abilities and contributions to your club. It could be within the system, or just, again, an interpretation of what carries the most weight in this process.
This is the first year after the new CBA. Is there anything different that you think may have led to more reason for potential hearings, or is it just happenstance?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't think so. I think carrying 13 into, you know, the sprint that existed last year, once the new CBA was agreed to opening day, I think that probably was a more challenging environment to get things done. This one, like I said, I think with just some unique player journeys to this point, and how they're interpreted, yeah, it's just, there's room for a lot of different interpretations, and not right or wrong, just a matter of, that's why this process exists. That's why you put it to a panel. But I don't think there's a whole lot outside of just going through the efforts. And this was a year where we had some unique cases, and you have this part of the process in place for there to be a fair resolution for all parties.
And you and many other teams are known as what are called file and trial teams, which, you know, by this date on Friday, if you didn't reach an agreement, you then exchange terms. With so many cases, you know, you guys are always adjusting processes. Is there any thought to maybe moving off that or adapting that in the future, or is this kind of the best way for you guys to go about things?
No, I don't believe so. Look, at some point in this process, there has to be a deadline, and there needs to be a time, whatever that may be, to put the pencils down and to feel like, hey, we've put our best foot forward. You know, everyone's put their best foot forward, and this is where we are, and then we have to move on to the next step. I don't think that there is, you know, somewhere in there has to be a deadline, and whether that deadline is today or whether that deadline is the moment before you walk into a hearing room, I think we're all going to gravitate towards a deadline. And I think this is a perfectly reasonable place on the calendar where time is available to really allocate to this, to try to get this done. And I don't think that there's, you know, if the deadline is a week ago or it's 2 weeks forward or anywhere in between, I really don't think it has much of an impact. Somewhere there's got to be a deadline to push both sides to their max. And, you know, now we have clarity and we go forward from here.
Well, good luck in going forward. Obviously, a lot of work to do on that and also getting ready for the start of spring training. We appreciate a few minutes on the podcast.
All right. Thanks, Neil. Appreciate it.
That's Rays President of Baseball Operations, Eric Neander. We appreciate him joining us. Now, obviously, not easy to have 7 cases, but I think Eric kind of put it in perspective. It doesn't change the fact that the players are or aren't going to be with the Rays in 2023. It just means they have to determine what their salary is going to be, and an arbiter will help determine that. Now, moving forward, the Rays signing a group of 24 players overall, 12 coming from Dominican Republic, 12 from Venezuela. Probably the two to be highlighted in this class are Braylor Guerrero, who the Rays see as a top 5 prospect in the latest class internationally, as well as a pitcher who the Rays are very high on, and that's Jose Urbina. We'll hear about both of those in a minute, but we start with Steve Miller, who heads up the international operations for the Rays. He kind of took over that role with Carlos Rodriguez moving up in the Rays baseball operations chain, so to speak, and I first asked Steve to give us an idea about his journey to get into this spot.
Well, I started my career shortly after playing. I coached in college for 13 years, and then in 2006, I was hired by the Toronto Blue Jays as an area scout in the Upper Midwest, and my the first day on the job, Carlos Rodriguez was also his first day on the job, and Carlos and I worked together until 2010 when he came to Tampa Bay, and then in 2013, shortly after that draft, I came over here with Carlos and have been on the international side ever since. I started as a cross-checker with him and was a cross-checker until 2019, and when he was promoted to vice president, then I was promoted to the director of international scouting.
So how different, having worked on the domestic side versus the international side, is it, especially when you're projecting younger players for the most part? A lot of these kids are signing at 16, 17 years of age, where you're still signing, you know, a fair amount of college kids for a domestic draft.
Yeah, it's when I first did this, the first thing Carlos asked is, have I ever done anything internationally? And I hadn't. And at that time, I was dealing with Toronto. We were starting to make a shift from a heavy college philosophy to projectable high school kids. So not only was I foreign to the international market, but also fairly foreign to a lot of projection. And so when I came over, it was a certainly a transition period, but it didn't take very long to have an idea of what you were kind of looking for. And a lot of that was because, as I said, Carlos was a good mentor, but we really take a simple philosophy. The farther they are away from the big leagues, the more they have to look, right. So the more the deliveries have to look like a starter, the more they have to look, the more the swing has to look, like there's some fundamental, foundations to it. So in when you're dealing with an older kid, generally it's you're looking at stuff and how the stuff crosses the plate. When you're looking at a younger kid, it's how the arm action and the delivery work. So it's just a lot more projection when you're dealing with the younger kids. It's a lot more fun because it's, in many cases, you're looking at a blank canvas, and you really have to kind of squint to really see what these kids can be in the future at times. But every single day I wake up on the international side, especially in certain countries, but every day I wake up, I really think that today I'm going to see a big leaguer. I don't know if he's going to be 12 years old or 22 years old. I don't know if he's going to be a shortstop or a right-handed pitcher, but I really have that feeling every day that I go to the ballpark now that there's going to be a big leaguer.
And you guys have had a lot of success in recent years with the international side. What characterized this class for the Rays, and what do you like about it?
This class, it's, you know, so many of these classes now are starting to blend together because we're looking at so many classes at the same time. We're watching guys, obviously, that are eligible to sign now. We were watching guys that aren't going to be eligible to sign until 2027, starting to build history with them. So the last CBA, when teams started finding out how much money they had to spend, we really started working in advance in terms of building history with these players. So we really started looking at not only guys that were signing for this year, but we also started, as I said, looking at classes 2, 3, 4 years down the road so we can try to build some history with those players. So when they are eligible, we can put ourselves in a better position to make a better decision. In terms of this class, I think that this class has some really high-end talent, but it also is a pretty deep class. And I think that there were a lot of position players, and I think there will be a lot of position players later in the draft, later in the signing for not the big bonus guys, who will end up developing into some of the better players in the class. I am really happy with some of the players that we got at the top end of our class, but I feel really good about some of the guys that we were able to save some money on. And I really think that a couple of our better players may come from some of the players that we didn't give as the high signing bonus.
The Rays have had a history there, and we'll get to that as well. But let's start with the top. You signed a Guerrero, not from the same family, but this one is a corner outfielder. Tell us a little bit about him and what makes him potentially a special kid.
Well, the first time we saw Braylor, he was Bobby Heck was down there with us, and Bobby is outstanding. He's has a ton of knowledge and a ton of history and experience, and he comes down and helps us out a lot on the international side. And he was on one side of the fence, and I was on the other side, and we're both watching this guy with Danny Santana. And Danny's our supervisor in the Dominican, and I think he's as good as it gets in on the international stage. And he took us to see Braylor, and the first swing that he took, I text Danny, and we were at the same game but different areas of the field, and I said, is this Juan Soto? And I'm not saying he's Juan. Juan is a really special guy, and Braylor doesn't have the same field to hit that Juan has, and Juan has an elite field to hit. But it was similar comparison when I'm seeing him. He's a left-handed hitter. He has present-day size, present-day power, present-day bat speed. He just could really put on a show. And at the time, he was running okay, but not great. And at the time, he threw okay, but not great. And as we've watched him progress, the foot speed has improved from like a 7.360 to a 6.95. The arm strength has improved from 86 to 88 from the outfield to now he's 92, 94. So he's continued to improve even after we first saw him. And as we've collected information on him through live at-bats, he's shown more than just a power over bat. Now he's actually showing the ability to hit, and it's just we're just blessed that he has power to go along with it.
How about the other stuff, the intangibles? What makes this kid a good kid? Because that's important, too, when you're giving out a large bonus to a kid who's considered one of, depending on where you look at the rankings, the top 8 or top 12 prospects in this class.
Yeah, he has a really good family life and a very good work ethic, very strong work ethic. And as I said, he's improved in many different areas, and I attribute that to his trainer, who does a really nice job with him, but also his work ethic. And the one thing that we're going to have to work with Braylor on is he's very hard on himself. He expects a lot out of himself, and when he has, when he doesn't perform to his level of expectations, he beats himself up pretty good. And this is a game where you can easily beat yourself up frequently with the amount of failure that happens in this game. So I do think that we need to keep him grounded to some degree. He does have high expectations, and which is part of the reason that he's done so well and part of the reasons that we like him. But we also need to, he needs to understand, and he will, but he needs to understand that it's a hard game and hitting's the hard part of it. So give him some time to catch up with the speed of the game and start realizing that we can't necessarily judge the results, but judge the process. And when he gets to that point, then we really think he can take off.
The top pitcher that you guys have signed kind of has come on a little bit later and was probably more projectable. What, Jose Urbina?
Yeah, Jose. We saw Jose when he was in Colombia. He's from Venezuela, and a lot of the players in Venezuela are going to Colombia now since it's so difficult to get into Venezuela. And we saw Jose at a showcase, and he pitched really well, and he was getting ready to leave that afternoon to go back to Venezuela. And we were fortunate that he stayed an extra couple days so he could pitch for us again. We wanted to make sure we had a second look at him. And the first look was good. He threw strikes and commanded the ball and showed some feel for a breaking ball. And at the time, he was 88, 90. And we liked how he competed on the mound, but it was a short stint. It was a two-inning showcase-type look. And so we really wanted to see how he competed in games, how he handled adversity, and if he just happened to have a good day or if he actually has command. So he stuck around, as I said, and we put him in a game situation, and Angel Contreras, our scout in Colombia, was able to set all that up for us and did a really nice job. And the same thing that we saw that first day, we saw from Jose that second day. He really commanded the ball well, especially for a 15-year-old kid. He threw a bunch of strikes, and he's still 88 to 90. He flashed a couple of breaking balls that showed future potential to be an above-average pitch. He didn't really have a changeup at the time, but at that time, at that age, few kids do, and why would you feature it anyway when you're 88, 90 and facing hitters that are having a hard time catching up to that? You know, no reason to speed their bats up. But so anyway, we were able to see Jose more, and some of our pitching coaches were able to work with him. And they worked with him with the changeup. And in the same day they worked with him, he threw a game in an instructional league and was able to show that changeup. And there were two of them that were above average pitches. So he showed aptitude, he showed competitiveness, he showed work ethic, he showed pitchability. And his tools started to pop a little bit. And he was 88, 90 when the first time I saw him. And by the time, the last time I saw him, he was 94, 98 with a plus breaking ball. And as I said, two changeups that showed signs of being plus in the future. So we thought Jose was going to be this good. We just didn't know he was going to be this good this quickly.
Be interesting to follow his evolution for sure. The Rays have had a history, too, of finding those guys who you're projecting a great deal. Vidal Brujan comes to mind, Yanni Chirinos. They were all very small bonus signees, but have turned out to be big league players. So who are some guys that maybe we're going to hear about further down the road that will take a little more time to project, but also have a lot of promise?
There are a couple infielders that I think can fit that mold. One is Jose Monzon. He's from Venezuela, and he's defensive-oriented shortstop who can really catch the ball, has above-average actions, and is a left-handed hitter. And he's really done a nice job of making contact. That's one of the things that we've been very, very impressed with. It's going to take some time before he grows into his strength. He's a strength-away type player. He needs to physically mature. Basically he's built like most 15-year-old kids. He's not like great Braylor, who's already has man strength, but he has above average contact skills, above average actions at shortstop. So when he grows into that strength, now those balls that are being hit over the right fielder's head start going to the warning track or over the fence. So when that all comes together, I think he's a guy that we'll be talking about in the future. Albert Palma is another middle infielder from Venezuela who has above average contact skills and has been a pleasant surprise defensively. At first I thought he was going to be an offensive oriented second baseman, but he's starting to show signs of being able to stay at shortstop. With his bat, if he can play shortstop, he's going to bring real value. We have a couple catchers, Alfredo Rodriguez and Jose Tovar, who I'm very excited about. And there's a shortstop named Yonangel Morris from the Dominican who has a chance to be a plus defender at shortstop, and he's a switch hitter who right now has strength in his swing. He's more of a power over bat, but he can really impact the ball. Once he starts making more consistent contact, then he has a chance to really be a guy that we talk about in the future.
What people don't realize, too, is when you're saying shortstop, and whether they stick at shortstop, if you have middle of the diamond type players, they eventually can play anywhere if you so desire. So if they all evolve into major league players, then you're going to be in a fortunate position more than anything.
Yeah. So many of these guys work out at shortstop and end up, as you say, moving off the position, whether they go to second or third or some of them even in the outfield. But that ability to bring value to the middle of the field, and I think all of us are looking for that. You know, there's two things that we kind of look for. If it's a position player, we're looking for guys that can stay in the middle of the field. If it's a pitcher, we're looking for someone who can start and stay in the middle of the order, or more middle of the rotation. As a hitter, we're looking for guys that can hit in the middle of the order. So we're looking for guys that stay in the middle, knowing that majority of them are going to branch out. But the farther they are away from the big leagues, the more they need to look like they have a chance to stay in that middle. If you sign a guy that has a chance to play first base and he doesn't end up playing first, then he's pretty limited to either DH or, unfortunately, a release. But if you do find someone that you think can stay in the middle, whether it be catching or center field or shortstop or starting pitcher, and the starting pitcher ends up being a reliever or the shortstop ends up being a third baseman or the center fielder ends up being a corner guy, there's still value. There's still potential defensive value, and there's still a place for him to play on the field.
And generally, classes for international size for you guys are what, in that 18 to 20 player?
We have two teams in the Dominican. Some teams do, some teams don't. Some teams are limited to one. So we have to fill a couple rosters. So we have a little bit bigger classes. We're somewhere between, in most cases, between 20 and 35. Now, some of those are pitchers to fill rosters. Generally, the guys that we speak about when we talk about our signing class on signing day, like you said, they're generally around 18 to 25.
We wish you the best of luck. Congratulations on the latest class. Hopefully in 3 or 4 years, we're talking about, you know, really high-level prospects coming through from that class and continuing success with the next groups.
Sounds great. Thank you, Neil. I really appreciate it.
That's Steve Miller, and we certainly appreciate him joining us to enlighten us on the Rays' latest international class and appreciate the time of one president of baseball operations, Eric Neander, as well. In the near term, sometime this month, we do expect the Rays to announce their minor league coaching staffs, and we'll have probably a podcast on that. We also have a number of Rays who are going to be involved in the World Baseball Classic, and I'm not only talking about those players involved, so we'll be talking about a number of staff members. We'll have a podcast on that later this month too. In the meantime, you can always check out our blog, raysradio.mlblogs.com, for a breakdown of the latest on Rays baseball. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will chat with you soon.